Blog Talk Radio. It's blizzarding outside, but toasty warm in here. But I always get a warm feeling when I talk about books, and I bet you do too. I'm literary New England radio show host Cindy Wolf Boynton. Today is Monday, January 26th, 2015. And if, like me, you're snowed in and have been told by your governor to stay in, you should give yourself the next hour to kick back with a steaming cup of tea or a chilled glass of wine to listen to four fabulous women talk about four fabulous books. We'll also be giving away the titles being featured tonight, which will happen as part of my conversations with Megan Mayhew Bergman on her short story collection, Almost Famous Women, Allison Jean Lester on her debut novel, Lillian on Life, Nellie Herman on her lush and magical The Season of Migration, and historical novelist extraordinaire Heather Webb on her sophomore release, Rodin's Lover. Heather is a Connecticut resident. Her debut novel, Becoming Josephine, about Josephine Bonaparte, was released in December 2013. And Blizzard or No Blizzard, Rodin's Lover, is being released tomorrow, January 27th. And, of course, I wanted to know if she was feeling pretty excited about it.
I'm very excited. You know, it's really different with the book not being a debut. You know, when you're releasing a debut, you are out of your mind. You have no idea what to expect or what to do or you know, how the public is going to take it, and there's just so much. But this time around, I'm actually enjoying it a bit more. I'm able to, you know, sort of relish the process, and, you know, the interviews and the publicity have been really fun and exciting. So I'm thrilled. I'm really looking forward to it coming out. So
what will you be doing tomorrow to celebrate?
Well, I'm going to host a online Facebook release party for several hours, and I've got two other authors who wrote about artists that are joining me, Betsy Franco and Anne Girard, and I'll be giving away prizes and whatnot. So that'll be the bulk of the afternoon, and then I'm hoping my husband takes me out to dinner.
Well, he should.
Yes, and there will be wine, for sure, to toast.
Oh, my, French wine. I hope it will be French wine.
Definitely French wine. If there's ever a choice for me, it's almost always French.
So take us to France and tell us about this new novel, Rodin's Lover.
Well, the book is set during the Belle Époque era, so 1880s Paris. It's a time when there's still a lot of change going back and forth in terms of the Emperor Napoleon III was toppled, and then you have the Republic coming back onto the scene. Artists sort of flooding into, and not just artists, you've got loads of workers flooding into Paris because the middle class is expanding and whatnot. It's a very exciting time. The bicycle is becoming popular at this time. There are bikes everywhere. This is really Claudel, who had to carry herself, my protagonist, and take on the art world by storm. There weren't a lot of women that were doing this at the time, and she was definitely one of the leaders there. So,
and the book follows both her artistic journey and her relationship with Rodin.
Yes, it does. I really, you know, there's a lot of books, not in terms of fiction, but a ton of nonfiction, especially on Auguste Rodin. And so I really wanted to focus the novel around Camille's struggle and you're such a fascinating and brilliant woman, and I just felt like her works deserve to be recognized and remembered today. So, yeah, I follow her journey into Paris, meeting Rodin, and then their tumultuous love affair, and the way they both inspire each other and shape each other's work. But I also talk a bit about the political arena for the art world, and then this issue of Camille's schizophrenia weighs heavily in the book. I mean, I show sort of how it developed into madness and how that affects both her career and her relationships with her family, her friends, and then ultimately Rodin, of course.
So this is the second French woman that you have chosen to fictionalize. Your first novel, Becoming Josephine, was about Josephine Bonaparte. Why that part of the world?
Well, I taught high school French for almost a decade. And so, you know, I've got a really good base in terms of cultural knowledge and historical knowledge around the country. And I love it. I mean, I love France. It's one of my favorite places in the world. I feel like it's America's my home, but France is my country. I very much feel that way. But I won't always write books about France. I've got a couple in the background I'm thinking about that will take place in the U.S. So you know, variety is a spice of life, and I definitely plan on dipping my toe into the variety. So.
Oh, I don't blame you. There's so many wonderful people to write about. But why her? Why Camille? Why Camille Claudel of all the people?
You know, that's a good question. I think part of the answer is about the muse. I think that sometimes we're just really gripped, writers and artists. You're really gripped by a subject on an emotional level, on a visceral level, and it's not something you can explain. And it's just sort of waltzes its way into your life, into your consciousness, and you can't separate yourself from it, and you can't stop thinking about it. And that's kind of happened with Camille. You know, I took a French film class in college and saw the movie Camille Claudel, and it won all these awards, and that was my introduction to her. And from there, it just sort of marinated in the back of my mind. But I went to the Rodin Museum in Paris a couple of years ago, well, I guess it's been 5 years ago now, with high school students, and saw it again. I mean, I've been there a few times, but it just sort of came back. And then as I'm in the middle of writing Josephine, I saw an ad that had The Thinker by Rodin, and it struck me like a lightning bolt, and I just knew that I had to write her story. So.
And now, she was primarily a sculptor. Did you take any kinds of sculpting classes as a way to prepare?
I did. You know, my daughter was in a ceramics class, and I spent some time in there with her, learning about some of the techniques. And then I visited. I took a basic adult ed class in town, where I live, and just to get my hands in the clay and to, you know, get a feel for the tools and the smells and whatnot. I wouldn't call it advanced by any means, but it's, you know, just a flavor of what it's like.
So did you, like, discover a hidden talent?
Oh, I don't know about that. given my subject, it's hard to think about myself as talented as a sculptress, you know. So no, I think I'll stick to the writing, actually.
Okay, all right. And you absolutely should, because early reviews of Rodin's Lover have been so terrific.
Thank you.
So thrilled. I mean, with the sophomore books, you kind of never know how they're going to go, what the reception is going to be, but yours has been fabulous.
Thank you. Yes, I'm beside myself, to be honest. It was a very difficult book to write. I grew a lot, I think, as a writer, and it's the subject was so different from my first. I was nervous, but I knew that I wrote the book in my heart, and that's what you have to do. So I'm completely thrilled with the reviews. I'm glad that they can see my love for the subject. I mean, I don't just love Camille, I love Rodin too. I love sculpture. I'm fascinated by these ideas of the way madness developed, or, you know, we would call it mental illness now. But all of those things. So I'm beside myself, really.
Is there something besides entertainment and the feeling that they've read a great story that you're hoping people will close this book having experienced?
I think every historical author hopes that their readers are inspired to go learn more. You know, there's so much I couldn't cover. I just really hope that they are interested enough that they want to go look up these pieces and see what they're like, or maybe think about a sculpture class, or maybe, you know, want to go visit these museums and look into the minds of these brilliant people. So there's definitely that. And the other thing, too, is I always, on some level, want my reader to reflect on their own lives, their own inner lives, and think about, you know, how, you know, love has affected them and things their lives, or maybe, you know, the relationships, the family relationships, and things like that. You know, inspire them on some level to look inward. And I hope to continue to develop that as I write more books. So.
And now you don't just write, you teach writing as well. And if I'm remembering correctly, you're teaching a class in Ireland this summer?
It's a retreat, yes, and not 100%, you know, it has to fill up for sure with attendees, but it's already, places are going, so that's exciting. So, yeah, I'll be leading, teaching writers how to edit their own work and, you know, how to look at the market and place their passion within a market space and things like that. So, and it's also a touring retreat, so that's really exciting. I've never been to Ireland, so I'll get fun in there too, as will all the attendees. So
that's wonderful. And if people are interested in going, is there a website they can look for to get more information?
Well, first, they should start probably with my website, heatherwebb.net, or it's called, oh goodness, Ireland Writing Tours, I think. And unfortunately, I don't know it exactly, but I will definitely have it posted on my site so they can go through my site to find it.
And what about locally? Are you teaching any workshops locally?
Well, I'm going to be co-teaching at the Graduate Institute in Connecticut next summer, or this coming summer. And then I also lead a Write to Publish class at Manchester Community College. It's all about focusing on what to do after the manuscript is written. And for now, that's what I have on tap. I'm sure other things will come up here and there. So
you're a busy lady.
I am. I like to be busy. And, I, after being a teacher for so many years, I couldn't see myself, even though I love writing, divorcing myself from teaching completely. So it's been really fun for me to continue to do that and to help other writers, you know, to reach out and share what I've learned.
So you have these writing events that are going to be coming up. You have events related to Rodin's Lover coming up. You have all this great publicity going on. Certainly you're going to have all kinds of more interviews as well. Are you writing right now as well?
Good question. I am. It's difficult. I'm having to really be smart and about my scheduling my time in my day. The first week of January, I sat down, you know, kind of under deadline. So I sat down the first week of January and didn't write a single word because I had so much promo stuff to take care of. But I finally started writing again this week. So, and it was hard to get back into it. You never want to really step away for more than a couple of days. I always say you want to touch the ball, like what my coach back in high school used to say. Every day you want to touch the ball. So yeah, it's been difficult, but I think I'm getting there. So.
And no hints. No hints on what you're doing?
Well, I can tell you that HarperCollins just bought an anthology I put together called Fall of Poppies, and it's going to focus on World War I era, the first Armistice Day, what happened to the people that were watching from the sidelines, as well as the soldiers, and how they sort of picked up the pieces of their shattered lives. So, and that'll come out in 2016. And then
that's fabulous.
Thank you. I'm very excited about that, and looking forward to working with 8 other authors. So that should be fun. And then I'm working on another Belle Epoque novel in Paris, but it's a bit of a gothic thriller, so a little different than the other two. Completely fictionally based, but still historical. So, and that's all I can say about that for now. So.
Okay, that's fair enough. So you've given us your website where we can go to learn about you. Facebook, Twitter, you're there as well?
Yes. So on Twitter, I'm at Ms. Heather Webb, and then Facebook, you know, just type in Heather Webb author and it should pop up.
And Heather, why should someone pick up Rodin's Lover?
Well, personally, I think it's a damn good read.
Me too.
It's fast. I like a fast, page-turning, tension-filled book. It's all of those things. But I hope that it's also something that people can learn about a time and that they don't know anything about, plus the art angle. And then, you know, who doesn't love an angsty romance? I mean, at least I do. So I hope that others find that interesting as well. So.
Oh, without a doubt, Heather. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Unfortunately, the Facebook event Heather talked about taking place tomorrow has been canceled because of the blizzard. I'm sure, however, that Heather will come up with something terrific to take its place once the snow has stopped, and she can be sure that her power is going to stay on. If you'd like a copy of Rodin's Lover, send a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Also, if you can't stay to the end of tonight's Literary New England radio show, remember that anytime after it ends, you can download it or any of our episodes as an iTunes podcast. Previous episodes dating back to our first show in December 2011 can also be streamed anytime from the Literary New England radio show archives. Author Allison Jean Lester, and that's Allison with one L, is a former Massachusetts resident and the author of the new novel Lillian on Life, which Oprah recently listed as one of 18 mesmerizing winter must-reads. Megan Mayhew Bergman's Almost Famous Women and Nellie Herman's The Season of Migration are also on that list. We'll hear from Megan and Nellie in a little bit, but first I want to share my conversation with Allison, who is nowhere near New England right now.
No, I'm in Singapore. I've been living here since 99, so it'll be 16 years this year that I've been in Singapore, and before that I was 8 years in Japan, and before that I also lived shortly in Taiwan and for a year in China. So I'm half my life now in Asia, but I did grow up in southeastern Massachusetts.
And now what are you doing in Asia?
Well, I actually came with just a suitcase. When I was studying Chinese in college, I majored in Chinese and in French and spent my junior year, that was 1985, in Beijing to really study the language. And then after graduate school, I did a Chinese studies degree. I actually moved to Japan. And that was just, I was recently married and we just wanted to try our luck. We didn't have jobs yet and it worked out. And my husband got a full-time job and I very cleverly got a part-time job. And that gave me the opportunity to start writing. I wrote freelance magazine articles, but I also started working on writing longer pieces of fiction. Then, when I moved to Singapore, I started my own business. Singapore, as you may know, is very supportive of commerce. There isn't a lot of business tax and It's a very good place to set up your business, so particularly back then. So it was a very good place for me to start my own training business. For the last 15 years, I've been doing corporate communication skills training and coaching, and that allowed me, again, to keep writing because it was my own business, and I did it. I did it a lot, and I needed it to pay the bills, but I could snatch writing time. Now that I've been able to be published with such wonderful publishers, I can do less of that and really enjoy focusing on producing much more than I've been able to over the last 20 years, because it's now 20 years of writing, you know, that finally coming to fruition.
And one of the products of that is your new novel, Lillian on Life. Are you just so excited about its publication?
I am. And I'm trying not to feel so far away by doing activities here, making my own fun around the publication. It's terrifically exciting to hear what the fantastic marketing department and the publicity department are doing in the U.S., and it comes out also in the UK next week. So that is also, that machine is revved up now. So here in Singapore, which you know is very small, I'm trying to make sure as many people who could possibly be interested in Lillian hear about it.
That's really fabulous. Well, please tell us about her and this wonderful book. What's it all about?
Well, you know, it's really about one person's experience of coming of age at a time when women were given different choices. So Lillian was born in the 30s. And so she entered her 20s in the 50s and became much more full-blooded in the 60s. And that coincided with her adventuring a bit. She was brought up in a very conventional family in the Midwest. And she took an opportunity to go and work in Europe in 1956, and she stayed in Europe. And when the book starts, she's waking up next to her married lover. She's 57 years old. She's never married herself. And before he wakes up, she starts taking stock of where she's been and how she got where she is and what she wants to do with what she's got left. Because what is very important to me about her is that she is still a very sexual person. She's still a very hearty and demanding person. And I think that that's an interesting it's an interesting thing to read about. The book is not tremendously plot-driven. It's very character-driven. So you're really getting to know her. The plot is kind of hidden. It's there if you want to see it. But as she reminisces about her life, you experience what she had to choose along the way as a woman coming of age in that period.
Where did the story idea come from, Allison?
Yeah, because I wasn't born then, right? It's not, right? I was born in the 60s. So
right.
as a result, this era of women is the gang of women that raised me. It's not my mother. She married at 24 and stayed married. But she was a very unconventional person, and she was a very open person. I think people who were brought up by women, men as well, but particularly women who spoke to you as if you were a bit older than you actually were and took it upon themselves to give you advice that may have come a little early in your life will understand that being raised by women whose achievements were very hard won, you know, whose may have received quite a bit of parental disapproval and, you know, had to make choices against the tide, they have a lot of advice for younger women. And I think I wanted to pay homage to these women and also to describe the type of people that maybe now we might not agree with them, but at the time, what would we have done in their shoes? That has always fascinated me. Plus, they were so gorgeous. You know, they were growing up in the 60s and 70s with these women, I was always very fascinated and very inspired by them.
Well, they were always dressed. They were, you know, always just immaculate, even around the house doing chores. You know, we might not get out of their pajamas, and, you know, they had pumps on and a scarf.
And she laments that, like, I feel the benefit of being able to stay in my shorts, but Lillian laments that, like, why couldn't you just do your, I understand that you're liberated, but do your hair, you know, that kind of thing. So I wanted to express that, even though I don't necessarily feel it myself, I really appreciated it at the time. And also so I think it was partly, I can't tell you 100% why it hit me, why I felt like that lightning of, ooh, I could write this. But I think it had a lot to do with being, I'm nearly 49 myself. I started writing it in 2007, actually. So I was, but already in my 40s. And I think that I was thinking a lot about looking back. I'm an adult now. I've got my own children. What am I telling my daughter as she becomes a woman? And at the time, I was single. I'm now remarried. I remarried in 2010, but I was on my own. And I have to imagine that it's, on some level, I was also wondering, where am I going and who's coming with me on this?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm of a very similar age. I'm 1 year behind you, and I find myself asking a lot of those kinds of questions right now.
Yeah.
So Lillian on Life, you've gotten wonderful reviews for it, Allison, mm-hmm. and you know, Oprah Magazine mm-hmm. picked it as one of a mesmerizing must-read. You have to get to this winter. How are you feeling about this reception?
You know, it's the best way to describe it, I think, is that I haven't been able to shave my legs when I want to because of the goosebumps.
No,
they won't go down. Is the feeling? Including this, the opportunity to talk to you, to be able to connect with somebody that I've never met who wants to talk. It's a great feeling. Like I said, I'm quite far away. So the fact that there are people, you know, I've been writing for 20 years, you know what it's like when you're like, I know I can count on my fingers and toes the number of people who feel like reading what what I've written. And now there are so many people who would like to read it. It's a very, very amazing feeling. And while I, you know, the writing part of me is very introverted, and it's there's a lot going on inside that I don't feel the need to talk about. I'd rather write about it. When it comes to I'm very extroverted in terms of what I want to know how people feel, not necessarily about me, but just how people feel. So it's amazing that they're talking about me and that they have feelings. And even when the feeling is, oh, this is so frustrating, people get frustrated with Lillian too. And I feel that's a success. You know, it made somebody care in one way or another.
Oh, sure. I mean, you made that connection. You made her real.
Mm. Yeah.
And I loved when I saw that you had blurbs from Erica Jong and Kate Atkinson and Julia Glass. And Julie Glass, I think, is just, you know, the ultimate. How fabulous.
Yeah. Again, it's like being surrounded by a bunch of women that I feel I admire so much. And that then it's just like a situation where I feel like, okay, now I get to be among people that can help raise me, pull me forward and give advice and feedback and to have a little bit of access to a community of people that have been stars in this firmament for me is amazing.
So, Allison, we need to start wrapping things up. Where can people go to learn more about you and your book and everything that you have going on?
As you can imagine, I have a website, and it's simply AllisonJeanLester.com. And I've written, there's stuff about the book, but there's also more about my background. And also, I've written a piece on writing about my writing process. And also, I've done a lot of performing and teaching of improvisational comedy. And I talk a lot about the impact of that. I can't recommend it highly enough to people, in terms of maintaining access to a very agile part of their brain, very, very important. So I've written about that. There's a video on there. And I also have an Allison Jean Lester Facebook page, and I'm on Twitter also.
And are you interested in Skyping in with book clubs or anything like that?
I would be very happy to do that. That would be fascinating to me to have access, because it's a very different community there. I'm very accustomed to people here in Asia, and as weird as it sounds, you know, I would be fascinated to see what it's like inside American book clubs in the States. So, yeah, that would be great.
The only thing I can think of is, because of your 13 hours ahead, though, while they're all having cocktails, you're going to be having tea, or, you know,
morning.
Your kids are probably going to look at you funny if you...
I think that it could work, because it's usually the evening, right? So that's the following morning for me. That's okay.
Yeah.
That's all right. No, don't you worry. It's worth it. Don't you worry.
All right. That's wonderful. Well, just a pleasure to talk with you, Allison, and much success with Lillian on Life.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Win a copy of Lillian on Life by sending an email to litnewengland@gmail.com or a tweet to @litnewengland. Do the same to win Almost Famous Women by Megan Mayhew Bergman of Vermont. Almost Famous Women is Megan's second short story collection, which offers fictionalized stories about, as the title says, women just outside of the spotlight. Women like Lord Byron's illegitimate daughter, Allegra, Oscar Wilde's wild niece, Dolly, Edna St. Vincent Millay's talented sister, Norma, and the cross-dressing Standard Oil heiress, Jo Carstairs. We started our conversation with Megan explaining how she got her idea for the story collection.
The idea came from 10 years of reading, basically. I think this book is really representative of my reading life. I spent about 10 years reading biographies of unusual women, women like Natalie Clifford Barney, who ran a salon in the Left Bank of Paris at the turn of the century and up until the wars. And a lot of these women were actually footnotes in her biographies, like Dolly Wilde and Romaine Brooks. They were characters that I came across who I found fascinating, but there was not as much written about them. And so my imagination took over, basically.
So you are as adept at writing nonfiction as you are writing fiction. Why write short stories? Why fictionalize their lives?
I think my imagination had already kicked in before I made the decision. I work a lot on an intuition level, and I think, you know, I was already working that way before I gave myself permission to write the book. And in many cases, the lives of these women have not been well documented. So one already has to engage in the act of imaginary play in a way to imagine their stories. But also, I wanted to animate their lives. I wanted to animate the risks that they took. And I also wanted to talk about their psychological landscape, especially as it comes to risk-taking. And to do that was already, I think, to make fiction.
Was it hard to imagine, say, being a two-headed woman?
Yes, in many ways. Although I have, of anything that, you know, positive I can say about myself, I can say that I am incredibly empathetic, almost to a painful degree sometimes. And right when I wrote that story, it's actually the oldest in the collection, I just had my first child, and so I was carrying around a being that was rather attached to me physically, but had her own agenda, you know, that differed from mine. So perhaps there was some empathy there.
Oh, isn't that so interesting? I love it. Writers, we really do draw on all of our experiences, huh?
Absolutely.
So now this is your second short story collection. The first, Birds of a Lesser Paradise, came out in 2012. If I'm remembering correctly, around 2012, short story collections were much more rarer than they are now. Just a couple of years has passed, but really short story collections are becoming pretty popular.
They are. I think, you know, their popularity waxes and wanes depending on critical attention and who knows, whatever the zeitgeist is. But, You're right. When I first put a collection out, I had no idea that they would be enthusiastic about me publishing a second collection as opposed to a novel. I do have a novel under contract, and so that is in the works, but Scribner has been very supportive of short story collections, and because they were the home to Hemingway and Fitzgerald, I can't lie, I love that. I love being a part of that tradition.
I don't blame you. I would love that as well. And you've started now to answer a follow-up question, which is, you know, have you thought about progressing to, I shouldn't say progressing as if it's graduating, but thought about the novel as well. So that's something that you're working on.
It is. I have actually already thrown away one. and I might as well just be honest about that. I mean, I want other writers, especially writers who are struggling or just starting out, to understand how hard it continues to be, you know, to put out good work. And once you've already had a book out in the world, do you know what it's like to have to stand behind your work and say that you believe in it and read from it nightly? And I have a really high bar for myself as far as what the book should feel like. It should feel like magic, and it should have that extra crackle. And, you know, the first time I've written two novels, actually, in my lifetime that live in an electronic drawer, and I don't want to put out just an adequate book or a proficient book. I want it to be magical, and so I really work hard at that. And when I do put out a novel, I want to feel as confident in it as I do with a short story form, and I recognize that's going to take some repetition.
So now, how long does it take you to write a collection like Almost Famous Women? And are you consciously, you know, saying, okay, I am working on a collection, rather than just writing short stories and seeing whether there is a theme that will bring them all together?
I've worked both ways. Birds of a Lesser Paradise was more organic in the way that it came together. But for me, I'm a person, and I know many writers are like this, I'm a woman of strong obsessions. So whatever I tend to be focused on mentally tends to be what I'm writing about. So it's not as hard for me to end up with themed collections, because they all seem to gravitate toward my obsession of the moment. And each book took about 5 years of active writing to come about. Although I have to say, there's a lot. I really believe that quality of idea in a book increases with the amount of time you let it percolate in your head. And a lot of these ideas and characters were in my head for a very long time.
So now, were you working on these books simultaneously, or was there some kind of crossover between them?
There was. I mean, I've told people I'm terribly unfaithful to my books. I usually am reading for it one time and writing for it one time. and my brain, I'm a passionate person, so whenever I feel the heat in a certain direction, whether I really want to be reading poetry or whether I feel like I need to write an essay, I tend to go where the passion is, because I know that the reader will never be more enthusiastic than I am as the writer. So if I'm excited about something, that's what I tend to work on.
And I believe that where you live in Vermont is a pretty rural area, and I'm wondering whether this pastoral landscape you're in is something that you think really fuels your imagination.
It does. I think there's something about, you know, wide open space and mystery that helps. And I've noticed it with my daughters. I have 3 and 5-year-olds, and they both have excellent imaginations, which sometimes, you know, translates into irrational fear. I always remind myself that when they're afraid of the abominable snowman, it's really the imagination at work, and that I'm probably doing the same thing on an adult level. But I am a person who needs to be in the country. I need space and mystery, and there's more of a sense of timelessness for me in the country. It doesn't seem to adhere to any particular time. There are things about it that have always been the same and looked the same, and I love that.
And now, do you still teach as well at Bennington College?
I don't. I would love to get back there at some point. I do a lot of lecturing and traveling and teaching now, but mostly I've been working on the books and the farm and the girls.
And that's lots to keep you very busy. Who do you think think will enjoy Almost Famous Women? And is there one woman that you are especially fond of that you wish you could sit down and have a cup of tea or coffee or wine with?
Sure. I'd love to have a glass of wine with all of them. But I know that, you know, one distinction I've made for my readers is that these are not necessarily likable women. They're more interesting than likable, more interesting than admirable. A lot of them made what we might conventionally call poor choices. But I'm still interested in the heroic feminine. So a lot of these women were risk takers, were willing to put it all on the line to close down that dissonance between who they wanted to be and who they really were. They really, I think, were pursuing, many of them, not all of them, were pursuing a sort of authentic existence. So that I find all very appealing. I'm most drawn to Jo Carstairs, the heiress who owned her own island in the Bahamas. But I think she would have been a really overbearing person. I'm also fascinated by Edna St. Vincent Millay's sister, Norma, who was a modernist actress and lived on Edna St. Vincent Millay's estate, Steepletop, after Edna passed away at the age of 50. And because I think she was fascinating in her own right and was apparently an incredibly wild woman. And I would love the idea of being on that, you know, 300-acre estate with Norma, talking about the parties that they had there and the plays that she acted in with Edna when they were at the Provincetown Players. So I think those two rise to the surface for me.
And do you think for people who are really trying to immerse themselves into the writer's life or create a piece of writing that they can then step back from and say, wow, this is finished. Is short story form, do you think that's the way to start?
Well, for me it was, and I'm not sure. I felt that short story, the form was in me. I mean, I'm Southern. I spent my first 30 years in the South. And the Southern literary tradition, I think, begins in the sermon, which is a very short, concise narrative, really focused on the power of language and rhythm and movement. And even though I'm a more secular person, I still have that sort of musicality and that short, punchy narrative programmed into me. And then, you know, then you have Flannery O'Connor and Eudora Welty. And whenever I read those stories, they just feel like home to me. I just feel like that's where I'm starting from. That's my genesis. That's my natural form. When you start in the short story, you're able to exercise a great deal of control over your sentences, your characters, your arc. I have found when writing the novel, one should obviously still aspire to keep control, but it is, for me so far, impossible to obsess over the sentences and the sound and to keep it all reined tightly in. I mean, to even engage in the act of writing a novel and to swim to the other end of the pool, so to speak, and just get a first draft done, there is an act of letting go that has to happen, for me at least.
And I know I asked you this question, but I'm not 100% sure whether you fully answered it, but who do you think will enjoy Almost Famous Women?
I didn't answer it, so you're doing a good job keeping me on task. Of course, I want to say everyone, but
of course.
You know, that would be the easy answer. But I have been really moved by the amount of women who have come up to me and asked me to inscribe this book for their daughters, either very young daughters, and I have found that incredibly moving. But as far as the people who might read it now, I think anyone who is interested in historical fiction and sort of more unsavory characters who were, you know, swept under the rug would enjoy this collection. I think it would especially be enjoyed by women who are fascinated by other women who took risks. For me, I've told people that I love a kick in the ass from history. I love being reminded that there's more than one way to be a woman and to live your life. And I take great inspiration from women who were out there living, you know, for themselves, for good or bad.
I love that. I love that answer. I'm so glad I re-asked that question. And Megan, we need to wrap things up, but tell everyone about your website address and where people can find out more about you and where you're going to be.
Sure. My website is www.mayhewbergman.com, and that's MayhewBergman.com. And I blog there and post articles and essays that I write. There's a great deal of pictures and an events schedule that you can look at. I am moving around quite a bit these days, north and south. And that's the best way to find me. I'm also on Twitter at Mayhew Bergman.
Wonderful. Megan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Nellie Herman's lush and poetic The Seasons of Migration tells the story of the little-known 10-month period in young Vincent van Gogh's life when the painter and his brother Theo broke off all contact. It's a beautiful book on so many levels, and you can get a copy by being the first to send a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to litnewengland@gmail.com. Nellie is a former Massachusetts resident. She lives in Brooklyn now. I really enjoyed talking with her and learning what The Seasons of Migration is all about.
The novel is about, it sort of takes as its focus a period of time in Vincent van Gogh's life when he was sort of having a major life crisis. He was about 27 years old. He had had a series of jobs that didn't really go anywhere, and he had decided that he wanted to be a preacher like his dad, and he had gone to school, but he had failed out, and then, you know, he said, I just want to bring the word of God to the poor, basically. So he ended up going to this mining town in Belgium and trying to be a sort of lay preacher there, and, I mean, not a huge spoiler alert, but he didn't become a preacher. And he and his brother Theo had a sort of falling out that the historical record, you know, we don't know actually really what happened, except that Theo came to visit Vincent and kind of said to him, what are you doing with your life? You know, you have to get a job, kind of thing. And it was the last time that they spoke or wrote any letters to each other for almost a year, which never happened again in the course of their lives. That's the period of time that my book sort of takes on as its focus, and I was really just fascinated by this sort of silence in the historical record, which came just before Vincent decided to be an artist and really applied himself to learning and producing art for the rest of his life.
Well, it's interesting because so many of us can instantly recognize a Van Gogh, but we know absolutely nothing about this man, except, you know, he lost an ear.
Right, right, yes. Well, that was sort of part of what I was trying to work against, was sort of this idea that we all, you know, I've overheard people at museums looking at Van Gogh's, and everybody has this narrative, like they know who he is. And you know, we know he was quote-unquote crazy, and he cut off his ear, and the few things that sort of exist, and he shot himself, and all these sort of basic facts. But in reality, of course, he was so much more complicated than that, and there's so much more to learn, so...
So this is your second novel. Your first novel is called The Cure for Grief. It seems like you've gone in two totally different directions with these books.
Yes, for sure.
can you tell us a little bit about that first novel, The Cure for Grief, and then kind of your thinking as you started working on a second one?
Yeah, so The Cure for Grief was a highly autobiographical novel. It was really based on my own life story, sort of a young girl coming of age with a series of family tragedies. And I think, you know, writing this second book, whether it was true or not, I was under the delusion that I was not writing about myself at all. It was total freedom in that sense. And I just loved the idea that I was doing something so very different than what I had done with the first book, having to do research and coming up with this world that I knew nothing about. It's funny because in retrospect, of course, now when people ask me questions, I see how I am present in the second book as well, of course. But I think going in a very opposite direction was really important and really exciting for me in writing the second book.
Well, do tell, where do we see Nellie Herman in this book?
I think, it's really in the sort of fascination, but I think it's a lot of why I sort of fell in love with Van Gogh, and I'm reading his letters and feeling like he and I had some similar obsessions is probably too strong a word in my case. I don't know if it's too strong for him, but, feeling creative energy coming from the land and from nature, I think is something that I definitely feel, as did he. Questions of the relationship between spirituality and creativity, which is a lot of what I do in my work as well as in my writing. Just sort of this question of, like, what is life for, ultimately, which I think at that time in Vincent's life, he was the fundamental question for him, coming to the end of his sort of spiritual understanding or religious understanding and wanting to find, ultimately he ended up channeling all that religious fervor into his art. And for me, I think, I'm not a particularly religious person at all, but I do see, the creative act as a spiritual one on so many, a lot of levels. So I think that's where the main connection is.
So I'm curious about the kind of research that you did to write this novel. I mean, did you travel around staring at Van Gogh paintings, trying to, understand the mind of the man and then go back several years before that, or what did you do?
I didn't look much at the paintings at all while I was researching. I mostly read, started with reading biographies and reading Vincent's letters. And, then once I sort of knew that I was going to focus in on this one period, I had to read a lot about mining and sort of try and get a sense of what the landscapes looked like. I tried to find, books of photographs about mining towns. I did a lot of research into the art of the period. I was sort of mostly looking to inhabit this character. So I wanted to know what was Vincent thinking about, looking at, reading, what kind of stuff was he doing at the time. So I read a lot of books that he referenced in his letters. I looked at the art that he was referencing. I always knew that my book was going to end before he really became the artist that he became. So looking at the paintings in some ways was not really helpful. I mean, all of that came later. So I was more interested in the stuff he was thinking about and learning about at that time and earlier in his life. So yeah, it's kind of funny. I didn't really do much research into him and his art. I did more research into who he was when he was younger.
I can't help but thinking, as you're talking about his letters, how are writers decades from now going to write books about people from our era? There are going to be no letters.
I know. I think about that too. It's very sad. I don't know what we're going to do. You'll have to collect tweets and Instagram photos. I don't know.
That's kind of crazy. And now, was Vincent did he keep a diary?
Not that we know of. We don't. All we have are the letters, really. It's kind of interesting, too, because he didn't keep any of the letters that Theo wrote to him. So, or maybe there's one or two. There are not very many of them. So so most of what we have is sort of only half of the conversation.
And were you, did you take any kind of European field trips to see where he grew up and lived in his early years?
I didn't. I basically looked on Google Earth, believe it or not, to see what things look like in this, and the mining town that he was in, that the book is mainly set in, it just doesn't, it doesn't exist the same way anymore. So they do, I think that they preserved like one of the houses that he lived in, but it looks like it's surrounded now by a pretty normal, you know, suburban area, and not, it's not a mining town anymore. So it felt like it wouldn't really matter in a lot of ways to go visit it when I was really trying to recreate the place as it once had been. So I didn't, no, I didn't go really anywhere. I actually haven't even been to the Van Gogh Museum yet, which is just a travesty on a lot of levels.
I think that you're owed a field trip.
I think so, too.
Definitely. That's got to go on the calendar for 2015.
I know. I know. It really does.
Now, I know that you live in New York. You teach at Columbia University as well as write, but you grew up in Massachusetts.
Yes, I grew up in Newton.
And now, do you come back? Not that you're that very far away, but do you have family in New England? Do you come back at all?
I do. I come back quite frequently, actually. My whole family is still in the Boston area, so I'm there probably at least once a month, if not more.
So in any way, did your growing up or spending time in New England, do you think that shaped you at all as who you've become as a writer?
Oh, without question. Without question. I mean, all the stuff I just said about being in nature, I think comes directly from growing up where I did. I grew up on a road in Newton where there, I don't even know if it's this way still, but there, we had about 4 acres of woods behind our house. And just growing up in a landscape where I could go out and just be outside in nature all day long, I mean, I think it makes a huge impact on who you become as a person. We also had a house when I was growing up in Maine, a vacation house. So, you know, the combination of those two things was definitely a huge factor into who I mean. The fact that I live in New York now, I still can't really believe it. I fantasize constantly about not living here. But we also now have a house in Cape Cod, which I get to go to whenever I possibly can.
Oh, how wonderful. I love the Cape.
Yeah, me too.
And so I know earlier this month you had a reading in Massachusetts at Newtonville Books, very wonderful mm-hmm. bookshop. Let's see here. Today is January 26th, and on Thursday of this week you're going to be in Michigan at Western Michigan University. Any plans, do you think, to come back to the New England area and do some readings and signings here?
I would love to. If you know anywhere that wants me, I'm there. Anytime.
Okay, so there you go. I hope that a lot of places are going to be calling you. And Nellie, is your website the best place for people to go to learn more about you and where you're going to be?
Yes, I think so. I'm really trying hard to keep it updated, although it's not my forte. But yes, that is the place. And if anyone wants to get in touch with me, there's a little email thing on there as well.
And the web address is what?
It's just www.nellieherman.com. And there's two N's on the end of Herman.
Two N's in Herman, and you're a Nellie with an IE. We need to wrap things up, but what is it that you want people to leave the season of migration having felt or experienced?
Oh, gosh, that's not an easy question. I don't know how to articulate that quickly, but I guess what I would like is for people to leave it feeling inspired and feeling like, you know, I kind of wrote it toward people who are, you know, what as Vincent was at that time, who's feeling very lost and unsure of what he wanted to do and struggling a lot with feeling like he was worth something, but not sure how to sort of enact that
that feeling of worth. And I would, you know, if people could leave the book feeling inspired on that level and feeling like maybe there is something out there for them to go do, that would be awesome.
Nellie, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Nellie Herman, for talking with me, as well as thanks to Megan Mayhew Bergman, Allison Jean Lester, and Heather Webb. It's not too late to win yourself a copy of any one of these fabulous women's books. Just send a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed listening to tonight's show as much as I've enjoyed bringing it to you. We'll be back again next week. Until then, have a great week and great readings.